Good morning, Brian. I'm talking to you from a sun-bathed forest in Israel with a lot of greenery on the ground after the first few rains. And yesterday I just was speaking with my friend João, and we talked about God and what God might mean. And at some point I got to the possible realization that God is so different to different people, so we must abstract something that is not any of these specific definitions of people. And it came to me that God might just be the kind of idea you turn to for keeping on living. I don't know, how does that strike you at all?
Hello, Eyal, from a damp London. I'm really interested in the idea of God being sort of different abstractions to different people, and maybe the idea that you turn to a reason to live, maybe. What it brings to mind for me is Spinoza, actually. So he talks about whether perfection is a good abstraction, and his understanding of God is kind of a weird one, that it's the same as nature, if I understand him correctly. But I've also thought myself that maybe, God is not best thought of using concepts at all. And so I wonder what you think about the question of whether God is conceptual.
Thanks for giving your input. First of all, I think Spinoza wasn't that weird. Maybe for his time he was weird, but in classical times, seeing God as nature was a common Stoic practice, if I understand correctly. He was doing interesting work with trying to figure out the world, going through things as if they were all mathematical equations. When it comes to God, I do think it's a concept as it's being communicated between people, and each person is telling another what they think it might be. But as far as I know, and I don't know much, but maybe we don't try to abstract the concept the way I did, with kind of taking it one level up to account for the many and strange and sometimes even bizarre conceptions of God, right? So for some people it would be a man in the sky, for some people it would be nature itself, for some people it would be the person itself who's thinking up God, for some people it's going to be a non-concept or something to deny existence from. But I don't know. I think that many times, and then maybe this is, will help us kind of expand the discussion, maybe past God and into other concepts. But many of the times, it's what we lack is an ability to account for the plurality of particular concepts and look at the universal, which in the case of God, it seems to be something like, oh, I'm going to turn to this concept when in times of trouble.
Hey man, hope you're doing well. I am walking through the woods on a very cold day in London. It's a bit icy. And yeah, Spinoza is weird for a number of reasons. One is the kind of attempt to do philosophy through these geometric proofs and in a way that's not necessarily obvious. I can never follow it, certainly. But the appendices that he writes to those proofs, which are kind of loosely related, are just brilliant, actually. And as you said, it may not be a new idea that God and nature are one and the same. Although, unlike the Stoics, I think he asserts that nature and therefore God has no end or goal, unlike humans, and that it's a kind of anthropomorphizing to assign goals to nature. And so that certainly separates him from the Stoics. It might align him more with the Epicureans in some way. But I like this idea that God could be an encapsulation of many different concepts to which people might turn in times of need or to go on living. I think that that's a useful way. It relates to this idea of religious pragmatism in William James and probably others, which is just Pascal is a kind of early forerunner, basically saying that if a belief in God makes us live a better and happier life, and in every way is just better, then the rational choice is a belief in God. So, yeah, wonder what you think of that.
Well, it might be time to then say something personal about my own set of beliefs, including the one regarding God, I guess. And, the last thing you touched on, is it rational to believe in God? To me, the question of what a good life is, which I actually try to frame as living well, because it's a process, so trying to use the adverb as often as possible, has to do with understanding what the good is actually, so we can live that. And then the question arises, do you have to have God as a concept in that framework? And for me, at this time of my life, the answer is no. And if I don't need to invoke the concept of God to live well, then should I be thinking a lot about it or turn to it when things aren't going well? So, you know, some people might say, oh, well, you haven't gotten to a place where this is needed yet, and good for you. It's not something that you need right now. I do think that following some certain threads of thought, you can end at what seems to be impasses, and then it's kind of hard when it kind of defies your rational thought when you are faced with a reckoning that maybe, you know, nothing really makes sense past a certain point, and it's all luck or it's all in the hands of some other being. Then, yeah, I can totally see why people are turning to God and that concept. And I can share that, you know, for me, yeah, there are times when I definitely think it's kind of all luck. It's like, yeah, we try to be productive, or we try to be wise, or we try to be all these things, but in the end, it's just luck, right? I mean, terrible things could happen to us in quick succession that would make us, even the most wise person, maybe incapacitated when it comes to living well, and not be able to actually act in a way that's very, that's inducing a very good feeling or something like that. But for me, so far, as I said, I just feel like God is just not a concept that I turn to or have a need to turn to. And therefore, I don't even call myself agnostic, but more like, I guess, apathetic or something like that. Like, I don't care about the concept for as long as it doesn't really serve anything, and I feel like I am living well for the most part. And then there's the whole notion of what living well means, and I don't know if we should get into that or not. Like, I'd be interested to see what piqued your curiosity in this message. But generally, I don't think living well depends on the existence of God or the belief in the existence of God, and therefore it's kind of not a question for me. And I hope this makes sense, and I'm interested to hear what you think, or some of your favorite thinkers that you've come across think. Let me know.
Hey man, sorry for the relatively slow response. I'm enjoying this epistolary format where we go back and forth, but I think it's been about 10 days since I got your last message, and a lot has happened since then. Been very busy, and now feeling a bit under the weather this weekend. So not exactly living the good life, although I Loved what you said about living well, and well as an adverb and living as the verb rather than the good life, which I suppose is adjective and noun, right? And I suppose the verb form emphasizes that it's a process and not a destination. To the question of whether God is needed to live well, I am not super convinced either way, and in particular, I'm not that strong of a believer in belief, if that's not a contradiction. I think that action matters more than kind of propositions, and so I suppose there's a way in which belief relates to action, right? You say you believe in God or you believe in some religion and therefore you take these actions. But in my view, the actions are the consequential thing. So if you do pray or meditate or do other rituals, then that's what matters rather than just a stated belief or even a belief in your heart or whatever like that. It doesn't seem to matter that much to me unless it leads to some kind of action, if that makes sense. And so when I think of eudaimonia, I think of praxis. I think of active living, what Arendt calls the vita activa, I think. And so that's like active community living in different ways, running kind of experiments and things like that, rather than just being a matter of, okay, I ascribe to this, you know, I subscribe to this or that concept of, you know, conceptual understanding or belief. You asked about impasses in rational thought, and I think you mentioned, yeah, that it might all just be luck. Yeah, I'm not sure what to think about that one. I have never particularly thought of the concept of God as a matter of last resort. I've had periods of, I suppose, practice and not practice when it comes to spiritual matters, and those are mostly in the Christian and Buddhist traditions, although I'm really interested in Taoist meditation practice at the moment. And you also mentioned apatheia, which I think is like not having a reaction or not having emotions about something, which I'm also really interested in because there's this strand of philosophy called Pyrrhonism, and they are typically understood as advocating something called ataraxia, which is unperturbedness or not being disturbed by things. And I think other philosophical schools also may strive for that. But I think in some instances, they're also said to have aspired to apatheia, which is just kind of no emotional reaction to things, or at least not to propositional beliefs. So the Pyrrhonists are really opposed to viewing things as good or bad by nature, and they think that this is the cause of a lot of suffering, the abstract belief that things are good or bad by their nature. So I'll leave it there and look forward to hearing from you soon.
Good morning. It's good to hear your voice. It's also been a few days since I received your message, so I assume you're feeling better, which is great. And now let's see if I actually have enough thoughts in my head to fill 8 whole minutes. It's an interesting experience now to hear a longer message and realize that it's not every point that's going to be addressed in my message, because it kind of diverges. And so I'm very consciously going to maybe cling on to one or two ideas that were raised and then take that branch without kind of showing remorse, hopefully, about not taking it in other directions. As you might know, I'm reading Ian McGilchrist's The Matter with Things, which I can't wait for you to read and discuss with me. I have this interesting idea that this could be the last book that I ever read, not because it's the book with all the answers, but just maybe this is a philosophical idea that we can discuss later. But it reminded me of a thought that I already had at some point, and I'm going to relate to the part you mentioned about God, and not just you, but me, and the whole discussion about God, and how it seems that at times, yeah, it's kind of a cul-de-sac, right? It's kind of a well, one might fall into a kind of a bottomless well where if you drop in it and keep occupying your own mind with questions of whether God exists or not, you might lose out on actually living well. And it's interesting because I see the same with quantum physics, surprisingly, right? So quantum physics is famously leading you into a spot where you have no idea what's going on and what kind of view to take about it. Is it a wave? Is it a particle? What the hell is it? And, you know, much like the question about God, you could really spend days and weeks going through all the different interpretations, right? And indeed, we see people that are thinking that there are multiple universes. We see people saying this is completely impossible, this is silly. We see people saying all sorts of things, and it's not so different from this discussion of about God and what it might be, and does it have causal powers, or does it just observe, or maybe, you know, just like you said, like God is actually, once it's explicitly said, it kind of slips and goes away, and what matters is the practice. All these myriad different arguments. And I think in both cases, it's very interesting because, at least in the context of quantum physics, if you look at it from a perspective of trying to live well, you'd actually do well to probably also go meta on the whole quantum question of like the two-slit experiment, and instead of trying to solve it, realize, aha, this is like a part in nature where the truth, whatever it may be, actually has no bearing on my living well, right? And you would adopt maybe a position, or I would adopt a position that's very similar to my position on God. Like, I'm going to be happily apathetic about it in the sense that I'm not going to delve into this because it's not going to affect my well-being in an obvious way. And it just seems interesting that one comes from theology. It's like this unquantifiable thing about God, and you could just go into these endless discussions. And the other one comes from science, ostensibly, but really very quickly also goes into the kind of the same realm of unquantifiability and just being able to talk about it as concept. And I think this is what it's about, you know, that we should come to these things and recognize that this is a frontier, that we don't know what lies behind this frontier, and this is as far as we can get kind of rationally, and that is probably the time to disengage from this left hemisphere, rational thought, analyzing, breaking down, viewing things as mechanistic, from a mechanistic perspective, and instead re-engage with life and go out to see friends and being a good friend and all these things that really don't depend on any kind of computation. So I'm very obviously right now heavily inspired by the matter with things. But this is what comes to my mind, and I wonder what you think about that, because obviously you've talked about how praxis matters more than appearance or the theory, which I completely agree. You know, the whole point, if you analyze Plato's dialogues correctly, which you at least know what I'm talking about by now, and I've given you many resources to kind of delve into and understand what I mean when I say analyzing incorrectly. You know, the whole point is just like you don't want to live a good life using a noun and an adjective, but you want to live well, use a verb and an adverb. The whole point for Plato is to make the shift in people's minds from having virtue, which is something you can possess. It's an object that's not moving in time, and replacing that conception with a conception of virtue that is active, that is actually an activity, which is phronesis. I wonder about that, and I guess I still have time to elaborate a little bit on my idea of why the matter with things could be, it won't, but it could be like the last book that I read, because I've been feeling this tendency in my life. It's almost like all these years of reading books and gathering opinions from different sides of spectra and doing all the intellectual work, it's almost like something that is really a process of healing until I get to the healthy point, which is to simply operate in the world and be very grounded in what's going on around me and never taking myself out of context in my mind and going into these abstract realms. Now, I'm not sorry that I did any of that. I think it's very important, and I think there is a lot of benefit and promise in taking the time to think abstractly about things and then apply it in your own life. But it seems like a watershed moment that I'm happy to go through when, you know, realizing that there might be an end to the search, and then there's start living. Talk soon.
Good morning, and great to hear from you. I've listened to your note a few times, but I'm trying not to take notes and work from that, but rather just let this go where it goes. So yeah, first on the epistolary form of voice notes, letter-like, and that was part of what I was thinking as I proposed this project, is that letters, you sit down thinking you know what you're going to write, but in fact they kind of go wherever they want to go, even if you start off in a place you want to start. And so I like the meandering way, and also the fact that they make new points and new connections. You spoke about McGilchrist, and I've actually started reading just the introduction just over the weekend, so I look forward to speaking to you about The Matter with Things, and would love to know how far you've gotten into it and what you're thinking. Last book, I not sure it will be my last book. I know you said that it wouldn't be yours either, but I think of books not so much as opinions, but as ways of seeing the world, meditations, ways of engaging with things, engaging with ideas, and so I don't really see it as a process that I would ever finish. And it's like trying out someone else's thoughts. I suppose I think of it as a kind of exercise in a way. And yeah, the connection between physics and theology is one that really interests me. First, it connects back to our first conversation in this series because of the root of physics, which is physis, or I think that gets translated as nature. You can correct me if I'm wrong. So at the start, we were talking about the connection between God and nature, and you're now making this connection between theology and physics. This is also one that Thomas Kuhn makes. He says that the training a scientist undergoes is more rigorous and stricter than any other discipline apart from possibly orthodox theology. But of course, in science, you're trained to be able to have some kind of dissent process as well, rather than just strict orthodoxy. And yet, he views science as roughly that which progresses, in part because they learn from textbooks in this rigid way, which gets them to the cutting edge very quickly, and from there they can kind of do more work. The idea that theology and science, or rather religion and science, are opposed is quite a recent one in the grand scheme of things. It comes from the 1880s. There are a few predecessors to that idea, but I think it's most clearly articulated in these two guys, Draper and White, who write popular books that kind of retell some of the medieval history. And even at the start of the 20th century, almost all of their history was debunked. And yet the story is almost just too good to be true. So people still think that there's this deep fundamental disagreement between science and religion, even though many of the great scientists that we think of from the, 900 years before that, let's say, were themselves deeply religious men. And I think there is a continuity, as Kuhn is kind of pointing to, between the practice of theology and the practice of science. They're both about fundamental questions, and they are motivated by a kind of assumption that there is order of a certain kind, and that it is apprehensible and understandable, to some degree at least, to those who investigate or contemplate it. Maybe that's another conversation that's longer and for another time, but I'd be happy to discuss that one. You mentioned the correct interpretation of Plato, and I think you're speaking about the Plato paradigm, which I will link to in the show notes. I've gotten through a few of those. I would be very curious to discuss that more with you, and whether you think aporia, or you can give me a good translation for that. I kind of think of that as like puzzlement, maybe, or something. I'm not actually sure what the right translation of it is the correct sort of understanding of what Plato is up to, because that's what I'm currently thinking about a lot. Yeah, and it struck me that some of what you were saying about phronesis, this idea, and praxis, this idea that we shouldn't remain in the realm of theory, and this relates to your point about the last book as well, that maybe at some point we put away childish things and start living. But I do think that that's compatible with continuing to read and learn and grow. Perhaps we take a more skeptical attitude in the Pyrrhonist mode of, intellectual humility, which I could hear coming through your message as well when you were speaking about the inability of quantum physics, or, well, let's say the inability of people to fully grok what's going on in quantum physics, at least easily, and also the kind of potential inaccessibility of the concept of God, or the inexhaustibility of it in any case. And that reminded me of something my friend said about Kant, which I have not read Kant, but I think it's this idea that there are these transcendental categories of God, the soul, and freedom of the will, or something like that. And I think, I could be wrong, that he thinks that it's the structure of the will to always want to know more, or to always kind of demand more, or push towards the boundary of what can be known about the soul, God, and freedom. But that is a kind of, I don't know if it's asymptotic, but it's like, it can never really be reached. In other words, in order to know what a boundary is, you must try to push past it. But in this case, as I understand what Kant is saying, you can never actually reach the boundary. And yet the process of striving, investigation, must never cease, which is also the Pyrrhonist position, which is why they oppose both dogmatists who think they've found the truth, and they oppose the academic skeptics who deny that any truth can be known. The Pyrrhonist position is very much aligned with my own, which is that we must never cease the investigation. And above me, you can hear three green parakeets, which are wild in London, and they're making a lot of noise. So I look forward to hearing from you, and we'll continue soon.
Okay, this took a while to get to for many reasons, and I realize that the format we've agreed upon means that I have 4 minutes now, which is an interesting exercise in kind of excising some of the parts and being okay with letting them go, because we're not going to expand forever, which is actually great, you know, because it gives me the idea that by the end of this round, and I hope and I'm sure that there will be more, by the end of this round we'll actually go down to 1 minute and then actually go and exercise what we've kind of discussed, and we're going to be phronimos and acting in the world. So that's really nice. Yeah, physis is basically just the activity of growing. So phuo is I grow, and phuton is a plant, a tree. So, and it's really interesting to contrast that with nature, which is in the passive. So natura, just the quality of everything, just the thing. So one is flowing and the other is kind of a snapshot in time, which is really interesting when you relate that to McGilchrist and his ideas about living in a mode of flow versus living in a mode of looking at things individually. And I think when it comes to religion, you know, the very religious, orthodox way of living is very, very left hemisphere oriented, because it is, in effect, you have a book that you have to go back and consult with every time you're about to do something, rather than just being in the flow of things, right? So it's very rule oriented. And this can be a problem in science too, which he actually points out, is that science has become this endeavor that's more about going back and looking at the numbers and quantifying things, and we barely see any scientific papers that are poetic, even though these do not stand in opposition at all. So I think both for science and for religion, there's a probably a healthy version, you know, because I've seen people who are spiritual and they're not even concerned so much with these questions about God or whatever, but they really just embody these very abstract, simple principles of just do unto others the way you want others do unto you, right? So this is kind of what stuck with me from your message, and there's obviously a lot more to unpack there. Yeah, so when you talked about Plato, yeah, that's correct. I was referring to the Plato paradigm, and I'd love us to discuss it more in the future. Yeah, overall, I think it's been a theme even in the time when I wasn't able to respond just because of where I was in my head. Of really feeling this shift from kind of cerebral point by point looking at the world and trying to analyze it, right? Analyze from breaking down, and rather trying to synthesize, which is go up one level and make everything more holistic and acting in that. That's been a strong theme in my life, and I'm still very, very curious to see where it's taking me, because I don't know, and it's to some extent anxiety inducing. So we'll have to see. Looking forward to hearing from you.
Hey man, absolutely great to hear from you, and I loved where you went with that. I love knowing that fusine is a growing word, and that I think you said futon is tree. In part, I may have mentioned this to you before, but the etymology of true in English is also related to the etymology of tree. And so something about what's true is steadfast or solid or dependable, like a tree. It's also related to druid, I think. And also the contrast between fusis and natura. Fusis being more flowing, more process-oriented, whereas nature is more of a snapshot. And yeah, I know you're deep in McGilchrist, and I love The Master and His Emissary. I've only read part of the introduction of Matter with Things, but yeah, it's thrilling stuff. It's really important, I think. And science is rule-following, or convergent rather than necessarily divergent. I liked what you said about the there's no reason there can't be poetry in a scientific paper, and yet you rarely find it for one reason or another. I think some of the early scientific papers in a lot of disciplines are more poetic. Often the people who kind of shift paradigms in Kuhn's terms are also quite good writers. I think that's partly what gets them read. I've remarked before about Darwin's insane stylistic qualities. He's just a phenomenal writer. Einstein is also a very good writer and a very funny writer. And so it would be an interesting project to do a kind of examination of when, you know, in their trajectories, sciences are at their most literary, maybe, and when they become maybe more filled with jargon or they become more abstract. It might be a transition similar to the arts, where the avant-garde kind of does something new and beautiful, but eventually that becomes sort of part of the mainstream, which is not necessarily less beautiful necessarily, but it loses something in that process of becoming popularized, right? Some of the weirdness gets removed, but also maybe some of the beauty. I also could really relate to what you're saying about shifting from this cerebral mode into a more holistic one, and from analysis, which I think you said was breaking down, into synthesis, which is more like building up, I suppose. And I love that idea, especially as you linked it to uncertainty at the end, because I am thinking a lot about my approach, what I'm calling neither nor, where you have to both do analysis or deconstruction as well as synthesis or construction. And sometimes these things align and sometimes they might be opposites. But central to that understanding of what I'm doing is the idea that it requires increasing one's own tolerance to uncertainty. So I would love to hear what you make of that. And yeah, and just enjoying this conversation. So let's speak soon.
Okay, now getting back to you on the podcast, finally. Yeah, good writers. I don't think that I seriously read Einstein or Darwin. I haven't read the originals, and like so many of us, I'm counting on other accounts of what's written in them, which is bad, but what can you do? There's only so much time to read these works, but I can totally believe that it's the good writers that are able to portray things in novel ways and in simple ways at once that are able to, basically garner attention, first of all, and also put things simply enough that the truth in them becomes apparent. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about how to shift paradigms in our own mind. I've been finding myself being quite productive with something. I've been looking at opposites or things that are ostensibly incompatible. So statements that seem to be standing in opposition to other statements. But this also applies to like human relationships. So my idea is that you could always find a vantage point, right? A perspective that from which you actually see that where you thought was a chasm between two opinions or two statements or two individuals, there really isn't, and it just takes creativity to cover that. Oh my God, only 2 minutes now, bye.
I love where you went with that. I've been thinking a lot about how we shift paradigms, how we transform our worldviews and come to see the world anew through defamiliarization or Yeah, ways of just shifting perspective maybe would be the easiest way to put it, and how that kind of inherently requires the confrontation of certain kinds of paradox. And paradoxes seem often from one point of view to be irreconcilable, and yet they may be almost required to do this kind of paradigm shift, or maybe they're one tool among many that can allow this kind of transformation to occur. And I've been thinking about that as kind of pushing in two directions at once. That could be like pushing towards pain and pleasure. So, I do yoga and also like bliss states in meditation alternatingly to kind of like calibrate or something. But I've also thought about it in terms of abstraction and the concrete. So moving towards reifying concepts and then kind of dropping concepts and going into experience. That's one that I've been thinking about a lot with regard to Schopenhauer, but it also happens in meditation. The Buddha seems to be pointing at this when he talks about the middle way between eternalism, which is like the reification of concepts, and nihilism, which is the negation of those same concepts, and that there is a kind of way to do neither, but it almost might require going both directions at once. I wonder what you make of that.
What it brings to my mind is ultimately geometry, or just these scribbles that we use to denote a wave, right, in tangible form. And it's right on the seam between the abstract and the tangible. These things, we don't take them seriously, a circle or a kind of squiggly line that denotes a wave or oscillation or something, right? And you can really think in those terms at some point and just think them. And I think geometry, like a defined shape that's kind of looping around itself and creates something, is one way. It's the still further way of thinking about things, while a line that goes on forever shows you processes and stuff. It's kind of this distillation that's fun to do. And sometimes I just imagine oscillations or shapes. What do you think?
I like this idea of geometry as being at the border of the abstract and the concrete. Spinoza thinks that geometry rescues humankind from a kind of ignorance. He thinks the problem of evil in the Old Testament leads people to think that, because they follow the will of God as they understand it, and yet they don't always get good outcomes, that they therefore have to take refuge in the house of ignorance, as he calls it, which is to say that maybe the will of God is unknowable to human minds, but that humans find a new kind of certainty, and that's in the certainty of geometry and mathematics. But that's potentially a conversation for another time. Wittgenstein also takes a lot from the geometric form. Good to talk to you, man, and we'll talk soon. This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam. where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.